Hello, everyone. I'm Drew Altman. I'm the president of the Kaiser Family Foundation on behalf of Jackie Judd, myself, who's our moderator tonight, the Kaiser Family Foundation. Welcome to the Barbara Jordan Conference Center. If you've seen my picture in the Washington Post, it's only occasionally been in the Washington Post, you would understand why a newspaper story about me when I was in government once described me as a nice guy trapped in a deadly serious face. So I hope I can convey to you tonight just how pleased I am to be hosting this event, to introduce this special effort by this book, this special effort by the Washington Post and the staff of the Washington Post to do something which is really quite important, and that is to explain health reform to the American people. If anybody appreciates the complexities of this law or the importance of explaining it to the American people, it's us at the Kaiser Family Foundation, because that's what we do. And I'm especially pleased to be able to just be the host here tonight for a couple of reasons. One is, if you know us, you know that we're deeply committed to health journalism. For more than 15 years, we've run the leading internship and fellowship programs for health journalists. And just over a year ago, we launched the first national nonprofit news service completely dedicated to in-depth coverage of health journalism called Kaiser Health News. And our editors and staff, many of them, are here tonight. And there's another reason as well that I'm very happy to be hosting tonight, and that is that we're longstanding partners with the Washington Post. We've conducted 22 in-depth polling and survey projects since, I think it's 1996 or 1997. The most recent was a survey of the lives of people in Detroit. And now the Post and Kaiser Health News are working together and jointly producing content. But the reason I'm most pleased to be hosting this event tonight is this one slide I'm going to show you just right now. And this is from why this book is so important. And this is from our April tracking poll. And it just shows you that so many Americans are confused about this law. We found that over half of the American people told us that they're just really still confused about this. And more than half, 56%, told us they're trying to figure out what this means for themselves and their family, but they're still struggling to do that. And as I travel around the country, and which I do a lot, and talk to people, they kind of turned a switch. As you know, some people liked this law and some didn't. But now they're trying to figure out, what does this mean for me and my family? And that's why this book by the Washington Post is such a big and timely contribution. I also think that, you don't need to look at my chart all night, I also think that the Post coverage of health reform shows, and this book shows, that at a time when journalism is so challenged, that really great in-depth journalism is still possible when there is a commitment to do it. I was doing a talk to a group of journalists in Boston just 2 weeks ago, and Alec McGillis's dad, who works at the Boston Globe, was there, and he told me what a great job Alex did covering health reform. Well, okay, it was his dad. But I agree with that assessment. Finally, let me just say before we get too congratulatory, there obviously are challenges ahead in covering health reform, you know, to provide the facts, which will be critical as the spin escalates, as it will in the midterm election season, to be the people's watchdog as implementation continues. And I think the biggest challenge will just be to follow the story as it moves out into the states and the marketplace and the delivery system, which will be a challenge for the media. So with that, let me present the man who has made the commitment from the top to the kind of in-depth coverage of health reform and health care that you've seen from the Post and that you see in this book, the executive editor of the Washington Post, Marcus Brockley. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Drew. Thank you all for coming tonight. It's always a pleasure to have a chance to meet our readers. I'd also like to thank Kaiser for all of its support, both on this book and in general, because we do work very closely together on healthcare coverage. If you read the Washington Post each week, you know that in our science and health section, there is a lot of healthcare coverage provided by Kaiser. It's a really first-rate coverage. The last few years have seen a number of epical shifts in Washington, a change in power in the White House, a big economic swoon, frightening levels of joblessness, and questions about American competitiveness. But no issue really transfixed the country quite as much as healthcare overhaul. And that's because, in a way, it was a tapestry into which all these strands of change were woven. 1 in 6 Americans didn't carry health insurance, and yet the country was spending $1 in $6 on health care. There was a near universal consensus that something had to be done. And so Congress engaged, the country reacted, and we at the Washington Post dutifully, or perhaps I should say joyously, engaged because we love a big story, and as Drew said, we like the details, we like in-depth journalism, and this was an opportunity to really bore into a subject of great importance. Healthcare is a subject that you will see us continuing to cover. As Drew's slide showed, there is a great deal of confusion, I think, in the country about what exactly it means and how exactly it should be implemented, and we are committed to continuing our coverage. The people who will be doing that coverage are with us here tonight, and so I will now hand over control of the evening to Jackie Judd, who will introduce them. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Marcus, and thank you, Drew. Good evening, everyone, and thank you for joining us tonight. I'm going to introduce our wonderful panelists from your right. We start with David Hilzenrath. David is an investigative reporter at The Post. He's written extensively about healthcare, including President Clinton's attempt back in the early 90s. In Landmark, he wrote about preventive measures and employers. Amy Goldstein. Amy is a staff writer for The Post, where she writes about social policy issues. Her contribution to Landmark include a lot of chapters about expanding coverage to the uninsured, Medicare, and dental and mental health. Cece Connolly in the center. Cece has been a national staff writer at The Post since 1997. She has spent the last arduous year covering the political story behind healthcare reform, and that is her contribution, this political narrative, in the beginning of Landmark. Alec McGillis, as we've already heard from his father, is a fantastic reporter and has been on the national desk covering a range of domestic issues. He wrote chapters on individual mandates, the insurance industry, individuals who currently have insurance, delivery of health care issues, Medicaid, and abortion. Wow. David Brown. David has been a staff writer at The Post for almost 20 years covering science and medicine. He has the interesting and added perspective of actually being a doctor of internal medicine who still practices once a week. His chapters cover how medical practices may change as a result of the new law. And because this started in a way with politics, let's start with Cece. Given the additional 7 weeks that you had to report this since President Obama signed the bill into law, what additional reporting did you find out that the law could have gone one way or another? Was there one pivotal moment that could have sent it to failure instead of success?
Well, first, thank you, Jackie, and thank you, Drew, and the Kaiser Foundation. It's a real treat to be here. Usually I'm in the audience here, Drew, so it's kind of fun to be up here tonight. To say that this law went through several near-death experiences would be an understatement. Beginning actually before it even began. I want to take you back to March 2007. Late on a Friday night, a senator named Barack Obama lands in Las Vegas, Nevada for an early morning appearance before the SEIU and the Center for American Progress with almost all of the other Democratic presidential candidates. It is a forum specifically on the topic of health care, something that Democratic primary voters care deeply about. Hillary Clinton is there, John Edwards is there, Bill Richardson, many others. Obama bombs. He's terrible. He's flat. He doesn't have any specifics to say about health care. He has no health care proposal. And a young woman in the audience basically calls him out and says, "I've been to your website. There's hardly anything on your website." He leaves immediately. He doesn't stay. He doesn't shake hands. He doesn't do any schmoozing with anyone at all. On the way out, he gets on the cell phone with his campaign manager, David Plouffe, and he says, "I flubbed up there. We have to get a plan." Fast forward 3 years, and Barack Obama accomplishes what no president in almost 100 years attempts and couldn't do, and that is a complete overhaul of the U.S. healthcare system, and the closest that we've ever come to universal coverage in this country. And the way in which he did it is the fascinating story that we try to give you in this book, Landmark. And what is so interesting is that Obama is someone, clearly in healthcare, and I think it applies to other subjects, who learns. He is constantly learning, and he is constantly tweaking the way in which he operates. And when it came to healthcare, we watched through those 3 years, but especially over the course of the past year, the way in which he kept tweaking his plans to make it work. So the initial strategy did not make the mistakes that the Clintons made. He had to adjust because he almost overlearned that. In the summer of July and August 2009, his prospects were almost dead. They were in such trouble that Rahm Emanuel, his chief of staff, called a very secret group of advisors, including his brother Zeke Emanuel, who's a physician, into the ward room next to the mess in the White House and said, we got to write our own plan. Even though we weren't going to do this because that was the mistake the Clintons made, we now have to do it to jumpstart this thing. And on we saw a series of critical moments when Obama and to a lesser extent Nancy Pelosi, the Speaker of the House, readjusted their plans in order to get this piece of legislation through. It's a complex law. It's very controversial. But I think no matter what you think of the final outcome, if you're a student of American government, if you're a political junkie, if you're just somebody who likes to follow what happens in government, it's a remarkable accomplishment that he pulled this off, he of all people, largely because of Pelosi and the way in which she really operated levers in the House of Representatives.
One of the recurring themes in your narrative is the power of one. And usually when you write about that, you meant the Bart Stupaks, the Joe Liebermans, the Ben Nelsons, but it also was the power of one, meaning Nancy Pelosi.
Yes, this is a theme that sort of returns throughout this narrative. And it's interesting because we think of the obvious power of one being the president and the bully pulpit and all that comes with it. But in the healthcare battle, there were other players that had their unique moments and opportunities to sort of leverage their power. Joe Lieberman, for instance, in the Senate. Ben Nelson is another senator because of the 60 votes needed to overcome a filibuster. They became individuals who exerted outsized influence on the democratic process and shaped the legislation in that way. For Pelosi, what was so striking about the way in which she used her power was the way in which she looked some of her closest friends and allies in the eye, right down to the wire, the night before the first House vote in November, and basically betrayed her closest friends and allies in the House, the supporters of the abortion rights movement, because she had to cut a deal with the Catholic bishops in order to move that bill through the House. And to me, it was a striking example of the way in which she used her power not only to cut a very difficult deal, but to sell it to her allies, who in many respects felt very betrayed by this decision, but she convinced them to go along with it.
I was going to say real quickly, after Scott Brown, it was really Pelosi who basically made the argument that they have to stick with this, they have to go with a big, stay with a big bill, not go small, not go teensy-weensy, as she put it, and sort of told her colleagues in the House and the Senate to sort of man up, as it were, and go for it.
And now we get to the law itself. He wrote the kind of opening overview chapter, Alec, and in there you said that while the law is complex, it's also moderate and incremental, and it's that very moderation that makes it complicated. What do you mean?
Well, it's something I tried to say often during this whole debate. When people would complain about the length of the bill, they'd say, oh, this is this 2,000-page monstrosity. It's so complicated. And I wrote a piece back in the fall that tried to sort of address that argument and pointed out that, you know, if you really wanted a simple bill, then you could just blow this whole thing up. And, you know, single payer is very simple. You just, you know, government runs health insurance. You get rid of all the health insurance companies. And there's a lot fewer rules to write. That's simpler. But obviously we were not going to do that. We were going to take a much more moderate market-based approach to this. And that means preserving, you know, the foundations of our existing system. And that means ending up with something, with a law that's much more complex, because you're sort of tweaking here and there. You're not just, you know, it's not tabula rasa. You're not starting over. So, but in its main elements, it really is a quite moderate and incremental approach. We are preserving the private health insurance system. It's modeled, no matter what Mitt Romney tells you now, this is modeled on the plan that he passed in 2006 as a Republican governor of Massachusetts. It's modeled on the Republican alternative to the Clinton plan in the early 90s. It's modeled on Richard Nixon's plan in the 70s. It's modeled on the ideas put forward by the Heritage Foundation early last decade, although they're trying to distance themselves right now from that. But it really is an attempt to build on what we have now. And because you're doing it that way, you end up with this messy thing. But it's really not that, the main elements of it are really not that complicated. What we basically have, but the best way to think of it is kind of a three-legged stool. We are expanding coverage by requiring that everyone get coverage. We're also telling the insurance companies that they have to provide everyone coverage who comes and asks for it. So, you know, they have to take you, you have to get it. That way you get the healthy people into the pool so that they can afford to take the sick people as well. And then to help people afford to get the coverage that they're required to get, you provide subsidies. But that's it. I mean, and you need all three legs of that stool. That's why you need to have the mandate.
This is why we have reporters, to boil this complex bill down into a 30-second soundbite. That was wonderful.
That's basically it.
Amy, you wrote a chapter about the coverage expansion. If all goes according to plan, an estimated 32 million people. And in writing that chapter, you pose some of the questions that need to be answered so that we can ultimately determine whether it works well. What are some of those questions?
Well, let me start before getting to those questions with a version of an answer to your initial question, Cece, which is, how do we do this in a couple of weeks? So the bill had just come out. The law had just come out. There wasn't even yet an assembled version of the law. We were still reading the House language and then what had been grafted onto it in the Senate. So we were all reading everything that we could find. And most of us, certainly I was, calling up all the smartest people I knew after years and years of covering healthcare, saying, what do you think this means? What do you think this means? And one of the most striking things that I found was that on both fine points and even moderately fine points, there wasn't complete consensus. So that I think that even though this bill, as Alec, you were just saying, is tremendously intricate and has a lot of detail to it, it's going to take a long time for what it really means to get sorted out in important ways. I think part of that's going to be done through regulation. Part of that might be done by people filing lawsuits who don't like it or want to push provisions of the bill more in their favor. So how this is going to play out is going to be a long, slow answer. So to get back to your question, you know, thinking about why it is that this law puts sort of such a centrality on getting people covered. Having health insurance is not really the same thing as having health care, but it's kind of generally understood to be a precursor to having health care. There's a lot of evidence over a long period of time that people who aren't insured have much worse health outcomes for all kinds of things, particularly when they have chronic and serious diseases. So the thinking is that if you get people insurance, that's at least a start. It's not the same thing as making sure that everybody has the right kind of doctor nearby, but it's at least an essential start. That said, this does not set out to do completely universal coverage, but Cece, as you were saying, this is the closest that the government's ever aspired. If this works, within a few years, some 95% of the legal residents of this country are anticipated to have health insurance. That's an extra 32 million people. That's a lot of people. But the things that will determine how well this works are a couple. One, will people actually get covered? As Alec, you were pointing out, the law says you have to do it. There are penalties if you don't do it. There are a few exceptions, but for the most part, people have to do it. But will those penalties be big enough to motivate people who don't like the idea of the government telling them they have to have health insurance, who think that they're healthy, they think it's a waste of their money to get covered? Will that motivate them to follow the law? That's a big unknown question. And let me just mention one more big unknown. Sure. For the first time, this law will give a lot of money to people to help them buy private insurance. There's a long tradition in this country of the government subsidizing public insurance. But this is the first really big investment in private coverage. Despite all that money, there's a lot of debate starting already. And again, this is not going to be knowable for years as to how it plays out, as to whether those subsidies are large enough to motivate people and whether, particularly depending on how medical inflation goes over time, whether the subsidies will keep pace with the rate of inflation or whether it will fall behind over time. So those are two really big questions, whether people will follow the law and get insurance and whether the subsidies will be enough to substantially help them do it.
David, before we came downstairs, you were talking to me about the issue that Amy just raised, and that is the challenge of reporting this story because the people you were going to who you might have thought would have known the answer didn't always. And that happened to you with the chapter about preventive measures.
Very true. You know, we did our best with Landmark to translate this very complicated legislation into plain, comprehensible terms, and it was often difficult. It was often difficult because the very people who wrote this law and who shaped it were hard-pressed to explain what some of these provisions meant. And that was certainly true of, you know, arcane points that really can be rather important to families across the country, such as whether the promise that people can obtain preventive services and screenings for diseases such as cancer, whether they can obtain those with no out-of-pocket expense, with no copayment, whether that promise extends to all plans, to employer-sponsored plans, to plans that were grandfathered by virtue of having been in existence when the law was enacted. It was also true of the question, what happens when health plans lose their grandfathered status? When they have to begin to comply with the requirements of this legislation, which ones will have to comply with which rules? And these are important questions. Even the experts were at times...
The war has already started between the consumer advocates and the insurers.
You know, as we explain in the book, this long, hard-fought legislative battle was really just the beginning of the process. And another reason why it's difficult to know what it will ultimately mean is that it now falls to government officials to write the rules, translating this legislation into more specific provisions.
And we had an example of that just today. The Obama administration came out with draft regulations related to dependents being able to stay on their parents' health insurance through up until the age of 26. So what were some of those details that we did get today that we didn't have 2 or 3 months ago?
This is one of the more popular provisions in the legislation, and it's one that the administration has been publicizing. It's something that can show people that this legislation is delivering benefits right now, even in advance of the legislative deadlines, because many insurance companies have said they will provide this coverage in the coming weeks. And what we learned today as the government rolled out the regulations for this is that some families will pay a price to take advantage of this provision. If families obtain their insurance through the individual market, and if they want to add their adult child, someone up to the age of 26, to their coverage, they could pay a price in two respects. First, they could pay an added premium just for adding a person to the coverage. But secondly, if that adult child has a pre-existing condition, at least until 2014, when the legislation prohibits insurers from charging extra for pre-existing conditions, insurers in this instance could charge the entire family a higher premium to include the adult child with the medical problem.
What was also interesting about what happened today is that the administration signaled that it's going to try to cast as wide a net as possible to capture currently uninsured people. For example, dependents who are married would be eligible for this. Was that a surprise?
I don't think that was a surprise, but we did get some clarity. For example, their children, the grandchildren of the people who are covered, would not be entitled to this coverage.
Alec, you wanted to jump in before?
Another example of this confusion about these things that we thought were all kind of set, just in the, I think, 2 or 3 days after the law passed, there was that whole back and forth about whether kids with pre-existing conditions could be kicked off their, you know, denied coverage. That was one of the big selling points that immediately as soon as the bill was signed, basically one of the immediate provisions was going to be that no more could children be denied coverage with pre-existing conditions. But the insurers then turned around 2 days later and said, well, actually, the way you wrote it here, it says that, see if I can remember, it says that we can deny them coverage at the outset. We just can't kick them off once they have it. But we can deny them coverage at the outset. And Catherine Sebelia said, whoa, no. But they had kind of written it that way. So they had to, basically through hook and crook, kind of pressure the insurers to accept the intent and not the language.
CC, quickly, then I want to get to David Brown.
This is the extension of the political battle, and it's going to continue. And you are going to see the Obama administration continue to beat up on the insurance industry. Why? Well, because all of the polling data suggests that it's a very popular, widely accepted villain, rightly or wrongly. So you will see Secretary Sebelius and everyone else in the administration stay right on top of the insurance industry in a way that you haven't seen for quite some time. But I think the more interesting thing to watch is who are the innovators in the private marketplace who decide they're going to try to get out in front creatively. There's a lot of money in the healthcare system. It's 1/6 of the U.S. economy. Somebody's going to get that money. I suspect that the smart players are going to get way out in front, be creative, innovate, and figure out how to succeed in this new world order.
Quickly, really quickly.
Picking up on your earlier question to Amy, as you pointed out, there are many things here that remain unknown, including, as Amy said, whether this coverage is ultimately affordable for American consumers. But there's another really big question that remains unanswered, and that is whether we bend the curve on healthcare costs, to use a phrase that the policy wonks have made household over the past year. The question is whether we will really change the trajectory of healthcare spending growth in this country. And that's perhaps the largest imponderable.
And absolutely imponderable. David Brown, I mentioned before you're a medical doctor. You still practice once a week. You wrote the chapter on medical practices. With the flood of the newly insured seeking care, given the current shortage we have of primary physicians, what did you find out in your reporting about the incentives that the government hopes will induce people to begin going into that practice?
Well, that is, of course, one of the many unanswered questions is, if you build it, will they have any place to go? There is a shortage of primary care physicians in the United States. There is a trend against people going into primary care. There's a fair amount of evidence that people in primary care, at least as it's traditionally been the practice structure that dominates, which is small practices, fee-for-service, little bit of ancillary care, but the physician basically doing the equivalent of flying the plane and helping you store the luggage and wandering back in the cabin occasionally to serve you a drink. This whole model is, many people think, will be replaced over the next 50 years with a team model, probably led by physician, but not necessarily so. And in fact, one of the interesting things in the bill is among the incentives, there is going to be money for nurse practitioner-led primary care clinics and operations. There are a number of very specific incentives in the form of money to train more primary care physicians, have more residency slots for primary care internists and pediatricians, money for physician assistants and nurse practitioners who go into primary care, money for the community health centers, the federally qualified community health centers, which is this hugely important and largely unknown form of practice that will actually probably be where a lot of the people, the 5% who aren't covered, will get their care. But whether the totality of American medicine is reconfigured into a team-based approach in which a a practice has responsibility for the care of patients over time, and they get some sort of bundled or capitated payment, and it's their responsibility rather than the highly fractured system that exists now is unknown. A lot of people hope that the incentives will be enough to drive it that way, but as Alex suggested, the bill is built on evolution, not intelligent design. And the as we know, or at least this part of the bill is built on evolution, and evolution is unpredictable. And whether it will evolve into a transformed medical care system is something that we can't say.
I want to ask you a follow-up question, but I just want to give our audience a heads up that in another moment or two, we're going to have people in the audience with mics. So if you'd like to ask one of our panelists a question, please do wait for the mic. Let us know who you are, and if you're here representing an organization, let us know that as well. But the follow-up is this. In what you wrote and what you just said, what I'm struck by is the distance between some of the rhetoric we heard during the political debate that the practice of medicine would be dictated by the government and forced to change, but what you emphasize is it's incentive, it's carrot, it's not stick.
Yes, and in fact, at the beginning, really nothing will change. There will be some things over the next few years that will change, perhaps not primary care, but medical care, at least. And I should say that virtually all of these incentives are coming through the route of Medicare and Medicaid. Lots of new patients are going to be covered by Medicaid. These are very large sort of trend-setting insurance plans. There will be hospitals will get, financially dinged for readmissions if they have very high readmission rates or hospital-acquired infections. But the average doc practicing in a 2-3 person practice will not necessarily see anything change except perhaps more patients coming and more of them being covered.
That's actually not by accident. And in a way, they decided in this bill to really, in a way, take on the insurance industry and to leave the providers more or less untouched. I mean, we're trying to get them to change their behaviors, but they're not really trying to bring the hammer down on the provider side in terms of trying to drive costs down on the provider side in a very aggressive way. That's the public option would have done that, but the public option was opposed by the providers, by the doctors and the hospitals, just as much as it was opposed by the insurers, because it would have resulted in lower reimbursements for them. And one big reason that they didn't push the public option harder was not just because of the insurance industry. They would have been happy to take on the insurance industry. It was because they really were very reluctant to really go at the doctors and hospitals as well. So,
Amy?
The point you're making, Alec, relates to two things. One is Cece's part of the book, which is the politics, which is that there was a calculation on the part of the administration as to who had to be in league with the administration to get this through. To some extent, it was the administration's philosophy or theory about what made for a good healthcare system. In other cases, it was just kind of pragmatic decisions about who could not be alienated any more than a certain degree. The second point that what you were saying relates to has to do with the point that just came up a minute ago about all the lobbying that's going to go on. You were saying that the administration is going to be framing things in ways that kind of are in sync with the public sentiment, so insurers are easy to vilify in that context. But in a countervailing way, I think that what you're going to see over the next few years is an awful lot of pressure from all the components of the healthcare system pushing to act in their legitimate self-interest to get as much as they can from the law. And, that's not an intrinsically evil thing. It's just different stakeholders have different interests. And you're going to see a lot of collisions, I think, play out. One of the big forms for that, I think, will be, as you all probably know, over the next few years, the Department of Health and Human Services has to make a lot of decisions as to what are the essential benefits that have to be, insurance benefits that have to be included in the plans that are sold through this new healthcare marketplace, known as exchanges, that each state is required in law to set up. Well, figuring out what's an essential benefit is going to have an awful lot of lobbying behind it.
And that's already begun, as you mentioned, first with the grandfathering issue we talked about, also the issue over the threshold by which insurance companies have to spend a certain amount of money, 80 or 85%, what qualifies as medical expenses?
I mean, this is a provision that is supposed to indicate that 85 to 90% of your insurance premiums go toward medical care. Well, you can imagine the arguments that will start coming forward about maybe there's an 800 hotline number that people can call and talk to a nurse. Well, you could argue that that's a form of medical care. There are certain administrative costs that may suddenly fall under this rubric. So you can see with everything that even good intentions and a statement that initially sounds pretty straightforward, there will be quite a bit of jockeying on each and every detail.
Is there a question in the audience? Raise your hand. Over here. If you could stand up, let us know who you are.
Hi, my name is Douglas Lloyd. I'm a preventive medicine and public health doctor, recently semi-retired. And I guess there's two things that I would like to hear the panel address, which they have addressed partially. Number one is, unfortunately, we have a medical care system right now that pays for doing things. It's procedure-oriented. The more procedures you do, the more you get paid. And, of course, since we don't have adequate tort reform in this country, the doctor is just as happy to do that extra test that the patient may have suggested because that protects them a little bit better on the possibility of a lawsuit. And the second portion of this question is what is – I've seen the Post reporting. I've seen it mentioned, but I don't think it's been given adequate coverage. If you go back just 20 or 30 years and you look at how we practiced medicine, how we did our diagnoses, since we were still doing chest x-rays back then. We had MRIs, we had CAT scans, we had a lot of other things. But since then, if you look at what's happened, it's the bending of the curve again. The problem is, for the same amount of people, not even talking about the new people who come in, but for the same amount of people we have now, we have new technologies for diagnosis. We have new medication. We have a pharmaceutical industry which has found the way of just tweaking the molecule a little bit so that they could go before the FDA and get a new permission.
And your question is?
My question is two things. What are we going to do about the curve? And the second part of it is what are we going to do about trying to change the payment system so that we have more emphasis on keeping the patient well and less on doing procedures?
David, do you want to take this?
Yeah.
And then Alec?
There's a lot going on, and I'll just try to address a couple of things. The question of whether the curve is bendable, I think, is a very good one. And the history of healthcare, really in the Western world, not just in the United States, for the last 60 or 70 years suggests that it's not very bendable and that it is it rises at about 2% greater than inflation or GDP or something. In any case, it's a parallel line with economic growth, and that most of that is explained by intensity of care and intervention, which basically means there's more stuff to do, and it generally you can do stuff. The more you do, the more expensive it gets. So that there's a lot of forces that are driving and will continue to drive the upward growth of healthcare spending. The one thing, or one of the things that is a possible countervailing force against that is, again, a reconfiguring of the delivery of care in order to squeeze the greatest efficiency out of it. This is not only prevention, but making sure that there are not duplicated tests, that things are done on an evidence-based basis so that you're not paying for things that don't have good payoff. And generally the feeling is the way that has to be done is in organizations that have a lot of things that doctors' offices don't have, you know, in starting with electronic medical records, with clinical prompts, reminding you when to do things, people that are probably not the physician doing essential things like following up on patients who've had new prescriptions, making sure they're taking them right, having the frequent contact with people who are very easily readmitted. Congestive heart failure is a classic example. It's been shown that if you have health coaches after someone has been discharged from the hospital, they go through a very dicey period in which over the next couple of weeks, there's a good chance they can bounce back into the hospital. But if you have a nurse or someone who goes out and visits them, talks to them on the phone frequently, you can get those bounce backs way down. All of those things will tend to perhaps not bend the curve, but keep it from rising as steeply as it has been.
A question on this side, up here.
Yes.
Just wait for the microphone, please.
Hi, my name is Bobby. I live here in the District of Columbia. I'll try to be as succinct as possible. My question is, how would the who benefits the most from this new law? People who live in very dense areas or people who are spread out in areas where there may not be that many providers? And how would they get access to care? And what would happen if more people than have been calculated go to those providers at one time? Who pays for them? And the final part is the Health Insurance Portability Act versus the this law that says that you must have coverage. How did the two of those, how did those two things converge? And who reports it? Who sees the information? State, federal, how does all of that play out?
I counted about 11 questions in there.
Sorry.
Thank you.
Alec. To follow up on what David said earlier about the community health clinics, they're a huge part of this. People haven't really, fixated on this yet, but these clinics, there are how many are there? Like several thousand of them around the country. There's tons of them. They're in the inner city. They're out in the, and there are a lot of them out in rural areas. They're, in some ways, they're even more important in rural areas, and they're getting tons of money. They're getting
11 billion
mm-hmm. more over the first 10 years, which is a
and
lot
that's
of money.
On top of a lot of growth during the Bush administration.
Bush. You're right. Bush scored
the
a lot.
The kind of health care that Bush really, really increased.
And the stimulus. The stimulus gave them tons of money, too. So you're going to have those. They're going to be taking a lot more people. I think there's a, you have to be careful not to overstate the number of people who are going to be coming in. Tons of people are going to be coming to the system, but the fact is that a lot of people now do get health care. People without insurance do get health care through hook or crook. They, you know, they come to the emergency room and they don't get it the way we'd like them to get it, but they do, and they get it too late, but they do get it to some extent. So it's not as if you're going to have 32 million people who have been completely invisible suddenly coming out of the woodwork. But as far as who's going to benefit, I think one thing just keep in mind is it's a very good question to ask, because it's really, this law is really primarily at the outset about people who don't have insurance, but also people who have been living in this really what I think of as a wild west of the individual insurance market. People who do have insurance, but they buy it on their own in the individual market, which is just, in a lot of states, a really scary place. It's like it's not a place you want to be. It's completely untransparent. You don't know what you're getting. The rules in some states, I mean, in some states basically have like no rules. I mean, Texas you can right now charge 25 times as much to one person as to another person. Like a 25-to-1 ratio. Under this new law, it's going to be 3-to-1. If an older person can only get charged three times more than a younger person. In Texas, you know, if you have like, I mean, it's kind of comical, the kind of stuff that counts as a pre-existing condition where you just can't, either you can get denied coverage or they can jack up your rates because of it. So people have just been out there sort of wandering in the wilderness. And these people are going to have this much more regulated, kind of transparent system starting not until 2014, where they're going to go to this marketplace called this exchange. And if it works, they're going to be able to just go to their state exchange, go online, and you're going to have these products listed by quality, platinum, gold, silver, bronze, different levels. You're going to know exactly what you're getting for it, different prices for the different rates. The big question is going to be whether these exchanges work. And again, coming back to Texas, one huge unknown in all of this bill is going to be how well states are going to do in setting up these marketplaces. how's it going to work in a state where the governor thinks that this is basically socialistic and is out there trying to, you know, putting up lawsuits against it? Like, is he going to be inclined to set up a good exchange? No. And is he going to be encouraging people in his state to get insurance? 1/4 of Texans do not have health insurance. It's stunning. 6 million people do not have health insurance in Texas. And this law, in a lot of ways, is basically about helping people in these certain number of states. What's going to happen in these states where the governors think that this law is just an abomination? Are they going to be encouraging people to get insurance?
Well, I think Bobby's question about access to care is just a searingly important one. And another piece of this is that the legislation provides a great expansion of the Medicaid program for Americans of lower incomes. And historically, the Medicaid program has had trouble attracting physicians, partly because it has paid them less money to take care of Medicaid recipients. It's been hard for people on Medicaid at times to get access to doctors. The law does make an effort to solve that problem by changing physician reimbursements. But looking at the picture more broadly, if the law, by reducing the number of uninsured Americans, creates a greatly increased demand for medical services and the supply does not rise to match it, it stands to reason that prices will go up. And if that happens, that force could counter or undermine this law's effort to reduce the growth in healthcare spending.
Go ahead, Amy. I was also going to make the almost identical point about Medicaid, but let me frame it just a little bit differently, which is that there's always been something of a stigma to Medicaid, both from the patient's point of view and largely for the reimbursement reasons that David was just talking about, from the physician's points of view. So one of the, you know, we're raising a lot more questions and I think we're answering things here, but one question I think will be really important to watch how it plays out is if you raise the income eligibility for Medicare, it's going to go up to 133% of the poverty level. That's That's much, much higher than it is currently in all but a few states. Will or won't that have the effect of destigmatizing the program?
I think we answered about 5 or 6. I should add that another author of one of the chapters is here with us, Howard Gluckman, who wrote the chapter on long-term care. So if someone in the audience has a question about that subject, we do have the expert. Yes, wait for the microphone, please.
My name is Bernie Cohen. I represent Insurance Solutions, which has its international headquarters in a spare bedroom in Falls Church. I'm an insurance agent. Recognizing that there are those in Congress who would like nothing more than to see private insurers go out of business, if the suits are successful about the mandatory purchasing of health insurance and the penalties, which I think are too low anyway, what happens with the mandate to provide everybody with health insurance in 2014?
Amy? Cece?
You're asking if the suits by the state's attorneys general are successful.
Yes.
I have to preface the answer by saying that most of the constitutional scholars that we've been consulting think that that's unlikely. They think that this is safely within the jurisdiction of the federal government. So just sort of preface with that. If those states are successful, it will certainly go all the way up to the Supreme Court. I'm not going to predict what the Supreme Court would do, but if they overturn it, you've cut the guts out of this new law. Absolutely. And it will make it extremely difficult to proceed with, for instance, a lot of the subsidies that are now envisioned for people to purchase their care. The whole reason why people argued so strenuously for the individual mandate and getting as many people as possible into the risk pool is that you need to spread around the costs and you want to bring in those young invincibles, as they're often known, young healthy people who probably don't get health insurance because they figure they're going to live forever and they'll save a few bucks. You want to bring all of them into the risk pool so you sort of spread around that risk and keep the cost at least somewhat under control. We've seen that in Massachusetts, and I know everybody's got an opinion about Massachusetts and how lefty they are, even though this happened under a Republican governor. But we have seen in Massachusetts over close to 4 years now an individual mandate that seems to be working pretty well in terms of bringing their uninsured rate is below 3% today. That's pretty darn good when you think about nationally the rate is between 15 and 16%. And the ways in which Massachusetts did it, they were very creative. They went to and advertised at Red Sox games. Why? Well, first of all, we all love the Red Sox, right? So we want to be there. And secondly, they knew that that was their target audience. Young, health, middle-aged men, relatively healthy. Again, don't think a lot about their health care. You don't have to show your hands, but gentlemen, how many of your wives or significant others are the ones that make sure you go to the doctor and take care of yourself, right? So they did things like that, and they brought a lot of people into that system in a relatively short period of time. So that's an encouraging sign. It's not a guarantee, but it's a good sign.
The worry, though, is that, just to follow on that, is that Massachusetts had this complete political consensus around this law. You had Mitt Romney on board, you had Ted Kennedy, everyone was on board with this law, and so you had this really kind of statewide propaganda campaign to say, you've got to get insurance. And they only had 9% at most, it was like 8 or 9% uninsured in that state before this law. So you had everyone sort of, everyone in their neighbor telling you that you had to get insurance. And how is this going to work in these states that have so many more insured, like Texas, like Florida, where you have the political leadership that not only is not on board, but is actually trying to cut the legs out from under this thing, and is telling you, you don't have to do this. You know, this is nuts. And so that's, I think that's the bigger concern with the mandate. It's not that it's going to be deemed unconstitutional, but that it's just going to knock it off the ground politically.
I don't think that's going to be unanimous. I think that, you know, all politicians are smart and they think about their own reelection prospects. And even though there are going to be some states and governors who oppose this law and want to go forward with those lawsuits, they also know that some aspects of this bill are going to be popular with their constituents. And so you will see, we saw this with the Children's Health Insurance Program when it was started. Again, not across the board by any means, but you certainly saw some states and some governors who were philosophically and ideologically opposed to it, but saw that it was a benefit for their people and wanted their citizenry to at least take advantage of those benefits. So I think you're going to see all different things happening across the country.
I think in comparing the country to Massachusetts, in addition to the greater degree of political unanimity and this massive public relations campaign to make sure people knew they had to get covered, there are also proportionally much higher penalties than the federal law envisions. And I remember doing a story in Boston not long before the last presidential election, trying to look at Massachusetts as kind of the best analogy to the then-candidate Obama's health care plan, talking to people who were uninsured. And they were saying to me, well, you know, I'm willing to pay a couple hundred dollar penalty this year, but next year when the penalty gets really big, I'm going to get covered. So that's
I have to admit, when I was reading the book, I was surprised that the penalty in the early years is as low as $95.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
For a lot of people, that's an easy call.
It's, it is not. It's $95 or 1% of your income, whichever is larger. So yeah. For a lot of people, it would be, you know, higher. Yeah. Than
well, let's turn to another question. This lady up here in the front.
Hi, my name is Elaine Melnick, and I'm just a interested citizen. And I'd like the panel to address who's paying for this. And I've heard different things, top 1%, top 2%, top 3% of the nation. And how do you feel that fits with our idea of spreading the costs that I've heard mentioned?
Unfortunately, the reporter for the Post who wrote that chapter is not with us tonight. Is there someone else on the panel?
We know that the tax changes are going to affect individuals who earn over $200,000, couples over $250,000, if I'm not mistaken, that they're going to see increases in their taxes coming along. We also know that many medical industries, the people that make device manufacturers are going to pay a tax. The insurance companies will be looking at a tax as well. The pharmaceutical industry, as part of that deal that they were negotiated, end up putting on the table about $100 billion over the next 10 years. Some of it is in discounts in the Medicare prescription drug program. Some of it is in some rebates to government, et cetera. The hospitals also agreed to around $160 billion over 10 years, lower payments from the federal government, in exchange for what they anticipate will be many more newly insured. So there are all different ways that sort of the $1 trillion over 10 years is raised through the combination of some taxes, some fees, some reduced payments, et cetera.
The taxes really are mainly geared toward the upper income mm-hmm. bracket. And the one tax that would have potentially hit more middle-class people was this tax on...
Cadillac tax
on high-priced insurance plans. And that tax was scaled way back. It's still in there, but it's...
And pushed out, right?
Pushed out and scaled
until
back.
Until 2018.
Yes.
Yep.
Right.
Another question. Yes, gentleman back here.
My name is Harvey Kupferberg. I'm a retired federal employee, 77 years old. So I'd like to know how this is going to affect me in Medicare as well as being a part of Blue Cross Blue Shield.
Amy.
Well, luckily I wrote a chapter about Medicare. So I know a little bit, but not everything that there's going to be to know about this. There are two big things that are going to happen. There are a lot of smaller things, but there are two really big things that are going to happen in Medicare. One has to do with the drug benefits, and one has to do with what's called Medicare Advantage, which is the version of Medicare that in which people get covered through private health plans. In Medicare, so-called Part D, as you probably know, there's been a fight going on ever since 2000. And let me just say that in both these cases, the changes basically amount to the Democrats finally getting their way on things that they really didn't like when the Republicans were in control of the White House and Congress and passed a bill in 2003 that created the Medicare drug benefit and did some other things in Medicare. So one of those, as you probably know, is that there's the so-called donut hole, this gap in coverage. After people spend a fairly large amount of money, there's then a big gap in which there's no coverage until a very, very small number of people ultimately qualify for catastrophic drug benefits. And it's not going to happen right away, but gradually, between now and 2020, that gap is going to get filled in. And this year, it's going to start with a $250 kind of check that you'll get back if you hit that coverage gap. And then, over the next several years, it's going to be a combination of some discounts on brand name drugs that the pharmaceutical industry will provide. There won't be any reins put on how much those drugs can cost, but whatever the price is, the drug industry has got to give a 50% discount off them within the donut hole. So that's one thing. There's also going to be gradually some subsidies that the government's going to provide for people who take generic drugs. So the combination of those things will sort of over time increase so that by 2020 that hole is gone, and that's a very big deal. I mean, all the surveys show that for older people, that's sort of the thing that they don't like about Medicare, when in general people who are in Medicare like the program a great deal. So that's one big change. Second one has to do, and it's sort of an indirect change for consumers, but it's ultimately almost certainly going to have an effect on consumers. And it has to do with how much the government pays those private health plans who enroll Medicare patients. There's been a lot of debate since the Medicare Advantage version of the program was started. There had been managed care and Medicare before that, but it was really kind of ramped up in this 2003 law over whether the government was paying the private health plans too much. And many health policy specialists who've looked at this, and almost all Democrats, think that they have been getting paid too much. So this law is going to substantially reduce the amount of money the government pays to private health plans. The ripple effect on that on consumers, it's hard to know what it's going to be, but it's very unlikely the health plans are just going to take that hit. So they may start to get rid of some extra benefits that they've been providing. They may even pull out of some markets. I mean, it's hard to know exactly what's going to happen, but it's pretty sure bet that something's going to happen that will in some way have an adverse effect on some patients.
Amy, to your point about prescription drugs, you mentioned that that the law provides that senior citizens who are in this so-called Medicare donut hole will get discounts from the drug industry. Their pharmaceuticals will be discounted. But discounted off of what? You said there's no restriction on the retail price.
Yeah.
So is it possible that these savings will prove to be an illusion? And is it possible that the billions of dollars that the drug industry has pledged to contribute to this effort by discounting its products, that too will be an illusion?
Maybe.
There's a question up here.
Subsidies, and that, are you talking about in the context of private health plans or just? Well, now that's a very good.
There is a subsidy that comes from the federal government.
Now that's a very good point. And I should have mentioned that when I was talking about the fact that as private plans lose some of their funding from the government, they'll do something in response. One of the somethings could be what you're talking about.
Yes.
My name is Scott. I have a question regarding long-term healthcare, particularly with an ever-increasing aging population. What's going to happen with it, and are prices going to go up or going to go down in general?
Howard, why don't you take that?
Well, that's convenient. The mic's right here. The main thing that happens with long-term care is something called the Class Act, which was originally proposed by Senator Kennedy and got in the bill, and it is a national voluntary long-term care insurance program. You would not be required to participate, but if you chose to participate, you would get a cash benefit for life of somewhere in the neighborhood of $50 or $75 a day. The actual benefit, the actual premium are all to be worked out by Department of Health and Human Services. The other important thing to know about this is it is designed as what they call a auto-enrollment with an opt-out. And that means that if your employer chooses to participate in this, you will be automatically enrolled in this insurance proposal unless you decide to opt out of it. That will work a lot like a 401k plan does now and with a lot of employers. So that's probably the biggest single change. It has the potential to begin to move us from a long-term care system that's mostly paid by Medicaid, 43% of long-term care is now paid by Medicaid, to a self-funded insurance program, which would be a profound change. The big question is, will this work as a voluntary insurance program? Most people know nobody buys private long-term care insurance. Will they buy government long-term care insurance? Don't know.
And $50 to $75 a day is... It seems so tiny.
$50 to $75 a day is actually not insignificant. More than 80% of people who get long-term care get it at home. And for those people, $50 or $75 a day can buy 3 or 4 hours of an aide's time. They can help pay for a neighbor or a niece to provide care. It's enough to pay, or almost enough to pay, for an adult day program for a day. So if you're living at home, it's not insignificant. Even if you're in assisted living, if you combine that $75 a day with Social Security and maybe a small 401k or a pension, you've almost gotten there. It won't do you any good if you're in a nursing home. It won't do you much good. But for most people, that's home care, and that actually matters.
Great. Thank you for being with us tonight. I appreciate it. I have two final questions for Alec and for Cece as we wrap this up. Alec, to you, what will the system look like if everything works as lawmakers had envisioned? And to you, Cece, in order for it to work as lawmakers had envisioned, it will require a lot of political capital being expended by the president. How much more is he willing to expend? Alec first.
Basically, I think insurers are going to become, if this works, insurers are going to become, you know, stop being the bogeyman they are today and become sort of like a regulated industry. They're going to have a guaranteed stream of customers and rules they have to follow. And in some ways, they'll be almost be, we're not really going to be telling them how much they can earn, but the way we do with the power company, but close. I mean, that's the idea, that you sort of rein them in by making them, you let them keep doing their thing. They can stay in business, but they're going to become almost like regulated utilities. If this really works over the long term, I think you might start seeing a shift away from employer-based insurance. I mean, they tried to preserve employer-based insurance in this whole system, because that's where most of us still get our care, get our insurance, and they didn't want to blow that up. But if these exchanges really work, and if they provide a lot of competition, and the rules work well, and they're transparent, and more people feel like that's a place that you feel okay getting insurance, it becomes appealing to get your insurance in that exchange, because you can, if you change jobs, change states, change employers, you just it's kind of like car insurance. You've taken care of it on your own, and you're not dealing with that scary Wild West that we now have in the individual market. So maybe over time, the employer insurance kind of very gradually starts to wither away, not in a scary way, but in a way that people feel comfortable about where this is going to. But that's all if it works.
Well, on the question of political capital and President Obama, I think that it has been and will continue to be a real point of contention within the White House. And the reason being that it's a difficult issue politically, as we've already seen for President Obama. And it ultimately probably will not be the determinative issue in the November elections, despite everything that we're hearing now. I'm a recovering political journalist, and my years on the campaign trail tell me that probably the November election will be first and foremost about the economy and bread and butter issues, and that health care becomes a subset of that political debate. In certain districts, it could feature more prominently. But President Obama, as we've seen, has been desperate to be talking about some things other than health care after having to spend so much time on it this past year. So if I had to predict, and I don't like predicting, I would guess that over the next few years, his engagement will be episodic, and it will be with an emphasis on trumpeting whenever a next good hurdle occurs or is cleared. So when you see that children being able to stay on their parents' plan until 26, you'll see the president out there trying to talk about that. He'll be eager to run out and trumpet the good things as they occur, and obviously quiet when there are bumps along the way, and we'll sort of see that go up and down over the future years.
Thank you. I always think there's something miraculous about getting a book published, even more so in this case because the subject you had to tackle and the time in which you had to write it. So congratulations to all of you. And thank you for sharing what you've learned with us tonight. It was really very interesting and just wonderful. Thank you. And thank you for being a great audience. I think the panelists will be staying with us for a while longer, and you're all invited to join us for a reception downstairs where you can talk to them some more. Thank you.